Welcome to another episode of Fight the Burnout with your host, Chris. And remember, we're sponsored by createfromwhy.com, my business where we help law enforcement prevent and overcome and eliminate burnout through fitness, through mindset, through trainings at departments, you name it, we got it. Go check it out. As I always say, I always like to start these episodes off with take one thing away. You know, I have said this a million times and I'll say it a million times more. We are in an information world where you can go Google anything. Hell, you can go ask AI things and they will tell you stuff. So we're not lacking information. We're lacking action. So as a police officer, you take action with a lot of different things. Take action on your own mental health. So take one tool away from today. I just want you to take one and go actually put it into place. Sit there for 90 days doing that every single day. And watch what will change over your policing career and your just personal life. Today we have a special guest, Meredith Moran. I believe I said your last name right. And she is another wellness trainer. She's going to tell us all about it. I'm going to botch it, so I'll stop. And she helps law enforcement, similar to what I do, to make sure that, you know, they're mentally and physically healthy. And she was a police officer back in the 90s. So she's going to tell us all about that. Before I botch it more, Meredith, why don't you take it away and tell us a little bit about yourself and your background?
Well, thank you. And thank you for having me today, Chris. Most people botch my first name. So at least you didn't go with Moran or Moron. Sometimes we get that one. I'm like, no, it's Moran. I'm currently now a licensed mental health counselor and a certified trauma professional. And I work with first responders and military personnel working with trauma and working with burnout and anxiety and all of that stuff that comes with doing the job that we do. So. No.
Well, thank you for what you do, and thank you for committing yourself to the cause, as I sometimes call it. How'd you get to where you are now?
So I started, as you said, I officially started my career in law enforcement in 1993. When I was 15, I became a police explorer. I decided at 15 I was going to be a cop, go work federal law enforcement, and then retire and have a cushy teaching job at the university. That was the plan. And so I did the police explore thing, got my bachelor's degree, and then started at my police department, went through the academy, started with my agency in 1993. Worked on my master's degree in criminology when I was there, kind of working toward that goal of federal law enforcement. 6.5 years into my career, two things happened. One, I developed really severe test anxiety and I couldn't qualify on my firearm. I've never been what you would call a natural shooter. It's always been something I've had to work at and struggle at. And I got super bad test anxiety. I couldn't qualify. My agency sent me to the psychiatrist to talk about it. And he said, you know, no doubt in my mind that if this were a real shooting situation, it wouldn't be a problem, but she's got test anxiety. And so I ended up resigning. They offered me a dispatch job, which I had worked in dispatch before. But at that point my stress levels were way too high and I was starting to get that mindset of, well, if I can't do this part of my job, how could I possibly be able to do this other stuff? Like write a simple report or communicate with other human beings, you know? And so I ended up resigning and moving over to the police academy. But the other thing that happened right around that time is that a colleague of mine who had undiagnosed PTSD died by suicide. And so those two things kind of coincided with each other. And I ended up joining the critical incident stress management team as a peer. When I finished out my law enforcement career and then moved over to the police academy. Also, while I was at the police academy, I became a reserve deputy to keep up my certification. And that was really cool because through some different training techniques and some different kind of, it wasn't like, oh, I'm getting, if I don't pass this, I'm not going to get a paycheck.
Yeah.
Type of thing. I was able to get through that initial qualification process. And it was still a struggle throughout that 3-year career. But yeah, I was at the police academy for 8 years. I was a training coordinator, worked on the CISM team, taught in the academy. So I did a lot of stress management teaching with the recruits, got my doctorate in counseling because at that point, I thought, I want to be a counselor. I want to help people like my buddy. Yeah. And not really knowing how that process works, I just was like, I'll get a doctorate and then I can be a counselor because that's apparently how I do everything in my life.
Fair enough. Fair enough. At least you know that.
Yeah. It's something that I've learned over time that, yeah, I don't really plan. I just go, let's do this thing. So yeah, got my doctorate, left the police academy in after 8 years and ended up at a nonprofit substance use behavioral health agency where I worked for 12 and a half years and then got my license during that time. And then 2019, I went out on my own into private practice. And yeah, I've been doing private practice ever since.
That's amazing. That's amazing. That's a, you know, and it leads from a tragic incident happening, you know, kind of really sparked a lot of really good stuff. So Meredith, let's go back to the policing career. You know, you're struggling with the firearms. And I know there's so many people out there that struggle with, maybe it's not firearms, but it's an aspect of the police. What'd you learn from that time? Like, what do you know now that you learned from that time that, you know, if you were back there, would have been maybe slightly different?
Well, I think the main thing I learned is that just because this part of your life isn't working out, that you're not screwing up everything else over here. Just because I was struggling with firearms qualification doesn't mean that I wasn't still a good communicator, that I couldn't take a report, that I couldn't, you know, drive a cruiser if I needed to, that I couldn't get into a ground fight with somebody if I needed to, that these are all separate issues. But at that time, my brain just shoved all that stuff together and went, if I can't do this, I can't possibly do this. And even if and even if I do qualify, how could I possibly go back to doing any of this other stuff? Because I suck.
Our brains are funny things. Our brains are just little kids, aren't they? Like
they are. Our brains are like, our emotional brains are just like toddlers that just run around and freak out over everything.
Yeah, they still act like, as if they're like, you know, as if they're a toddler and we're trying to be an adult over here, and it really is, we're being run by our toddler self. So obviously you help a lot of people now with different things. What is it that you feel you do the most when it comes to law enforcement, military, you know, first responders? What is it that you kind of would say that your key role is now after all that experience that you're able to bring to them?
I think for me, the biggest part of it is educating people up front. Usually the first session after we do the, hey, let's get your background and history and why are you here? The first session, I talk about your brain and I talk about emotional brain versus thinking brain and how trauma and stuff rewires our brain and puts us into that, you know, how being in that hypervigilant mode on duty all the time triggers that switch to be on all the time. So then we live our lives in this upscale hypervigilance all the time. And giving people that education that, hey, this is a brain chemical thing and we can fix it. I've had people sit back in the chair and look at me and go, so I'm not crazy.
Yep. I remember when my counselor did that same thing. She was like, Chris, you're burned out. You've got, you know, you've got stuff. You probably got some PTSD, but she's like, it's normal for your role. And I was like, and she rattled off all the symptoms. And I was like, huh, so I'm not crazy.
Yeah. And I think that's kind of the most, that's such a good feeling when you look at a first responder who's coming to therapy, who may not want to be there, who thinks that they're losing their mind. And then you tell them, hey, A, your brain isn't, our human brains aren't set up to see the stuff that you see every day. Human brains aren't set up to be scraping people off the road. And everything that we deal with every day, first of all. And second of all, your brain has just wired itself to adapt to that. But in doing so, it's put you in a perpetual state of fight or flight all the time. And that's causing chemical changes in our body. I'm dumping adrenaline and cortisol in my system all the time, which is not healthy. And so you're riding that roller coaster, and we can give you some tools and some tricks to get your brain to calm down when you're off duty, when you're not.
Yeah, it's so true. I say this a lot, and I've been saying it a lot to people that I talk to, you know, that are aspiring police officers that I'm helping pass the fitness test or helping them, you know, get through the police, you know, application process here in New Zealand, especially. I'm like, I wasn't even finished with training. We do a thing called station duty here, where you go back and you work at your station for a week. And you're a recruit, so you don't have any arrest powers, and you're not sworn, you don't have, you know, any of that. But my first day, I went to a guy who had been dead for 3 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
Anybody who's a cop knows, in the middle of summer.
Yeah.
Anybody who's a cop knows what that looks like and smells like. That was day one. That's like, welcome to the job.
Yeah.
And, you know, 4 weeks out of training, went to a guy who jumped in front of a train.
Right.
And so it's, you know, like you said, our brains aren't designed to do that. And when you aren't set up with any tools or any strategies to actually process that, and, you know, there are ways, and I would love to hear what your ways are that you help people with, or some, you know, general tools and strategies. There's ways to process it and process it fairly quickly, so you can then calm down. You can be like, oh, okay, yeah. You know, you'll never forget it. I'll never forget any of my dead bodies or any of the critical incidents that I went to, the suicides, the notification jobs. There's, you know, ones that I'll never forget. I can visualize, you can see them like it was yesterday.
Mm-hmm.
But it's ways to process the emotions that come out of it.
Exactly.
So that you don't sit in that. Because your brain, like you said, your brain sits in that chemical reaction of the fight or flight just from seeing the traumatic things.
Right.
So what are some of the tools?
That switch gets flipped into the on position. You know, a regular civilian, you know, they drive by an accident and maybe see a dead body in the road, and that's horrifying. But then our brain processes it. It goes, okay, that was a horrible thing to look at. And it moves on because, you know, in 18 to 24 hours, our brain just kind of processes that and moves on. With first responders, I'm going from one horrible thing to another horrible thing to another horrible thing in an 8, 10 to 12 hour shift. If I'm like over here, I don't know what it's like over there, but firefighters over here work 24 hour shifts. So 24 on, 48 off. Paramedics are working 12 hour shifts. And so the brain doesn't have any time to go, that was a horrible thing. Let's deconstruct that and put it someplace before the next horrible thing happens. And then when I'm off duty, so I work a 12-hour shift. I'm off duty for 12 hours. Part of that, I have to sleep. Part of that, I have to do other adult stuff, like tend to my family or stuff. And so my brain never has time to set all of that stuff aside and go, okay, that was horrible. Let's stick it places and process it out. It just goes. And so that's where we get this, okay, now I'm in hypervigilant mode all the time.
And it's not necessarily because you're constantly looking for threats. It's because your brain just sits there and goes, oh my God, I don't know how to process this. So I'm going to sit in fight or flight just to be able to somewhat process it. Plus then you add in law enforcement, you know, a friend of mine, a guy that, you know, Brandon Griffith, he does, you know, stuff for resuscitation for law enforcement, out of Phoenix, like high level, cardiac arrest and resuscitation trainings for law enforcement. And he did a podcast and he actually sent me the lady did a snippet of it for a reel and he sent it to me. And it reminded me of this. Law enforcement and even for firefighters and EMTs and that will go from one traumatic thing where, and he talks about an incident where, you know, he's holding a 4-year-old kid, I think it was, who passes away in his arms. And then he goes to a job where a lady had her bicycle stolen and she's wondering why he's two hours later, 45 minutes late from when it happened.
Right.
And so she's sitting there abusing the crap out of him going, I pay your taxes and all this. And I'm like, oh yeah, I had multiple of those happen. You know, you go to a critical incident where it's like, oh my God, like you're stuffing back your emotions so you don't feel anything. So you're not, you know, sitting there bawling your eyes out in the scene while you're trying to sort stuff out, car accidents, whatever it is. And then you're going to what turns out to be a civil dispute. And you're just like, so your mind doesn't, you know, it does this yo-yo all the time. So Meredith, go ahead. You were going to say something.
Well, and so then, what happens though is on that seemingly benign call where I'm being verbally assaulted by somebody, I snap and I say something that may be inappropriate.
Yeah.
I tell a citizen to F off, but it's because my brain is still back here, but now I've got a complaint and I'm in IA and all of this stuff is going on because nobody gave me time to, there was no time to decompress. And I get that. There isn't time to decompress in between sometimes. I had another thought in my mind. Oh, about being in fight or flight. The reality is, though, that if I'm in fight or flight all the time, I may not consciously be looking for danger, but my brain, my fight or flight brain, is. It is always on alert for danger. And one of the big problems with that is that if my brain is looking for danger over here, it misses the real threat over here.
Yeah. And it's interesting you say that because one of the biggest thing which I never jumped into, but the one of the biggest things you hear law enforcement say is I always sit with my face towards the door. And, you know, I totally get it. But I also sit there and go, if you're so focused on the threat that's coming through the door, what about the threats that are inside the door? What about the, you know, you're not being present with whoever you're there with.
Yeah.
And so on the back of the, you know, you're so focused on the threat over here that you lose the threat over here. It's that same kind of process. So Meredith, on that, because I know that you've got a whole ton of stuff. You've been doing this for a long time. What are the keys to processing this stuff quickly so that you can go to that benign call, as we call it, and not get an IA?
Yeah. And I guess we shouldn't say benign because no call is benign. It can always go bad.
Yeah, it can.
That was true. Yeah. So I think a couple of things need to happen. First of all, I think that and I don't know what your police academies are, but our police academies here kind of went into this direction where it became a very us versus them thing that, you know, we're teaching police recruits that everybody's a threat. Everybody wants to kill you. You got to be on high alert all the time. And that's so in the police academy, you're starting that escalation. So I think we need to balance that education when we're dealing with it. I think when I teach supervisors, be aware of who your people are. You know, go talk to them. When, you know, if the only time my supervisor comes to talk to me is when I'm in trouble, I'm certainly not going to tell my supervisor when I'm struggling. So know your people, know what's going on in their lives. I had an agency here that they were, the trainer was talking to me about an officer who he had just gone and he had buried his elderly mother and had been back to work. The day he came back to work, dispatch sent him to 4 back-to-back elderly death calls to investigate. And by the 4th one, he was like calling his sergeant going, I can't do this. And that's where I think as supervisors, people need to pay attention and go, oh, you know what? Dude just came back from burying his mother. Maybe have dispatch send those calls to other people and let him not do 4 of those back to back. You know, let's have process time. Let him ease back into this. But I think as individuals, so right after I teach people about the brain, I start in with relaxation and grounding and breathing. If we can learn to live in a relaxed body, and this work is Eric Gentry is a PhD who came up with, talked about a lot of this work. And it's also polyvagal theory, Porges polyvagal theory stuff. But if we can learn to live in a relaxed body, then that's a sign to our emotional, to our survival brain that we're safe and everything is okay and it doesn't need to be involved in the situation. And that, you know what, I'll call you when I need you. So I start teaching people right up front, check in with your body. Where do you have tension near your body? Are your shoulders all up in your, you know, are you clenching your, you know, is this going on with your body all the time? Well, if we're doing that, our brain is like, obviously there's something going on. We need to be on high alert. So let's relax our body. Let's breathe. Let's do some deep breathing. You know, whatever you want to call it. My steady minds, Dr. Seth Hickerson, they call it BAMO, breathe and move on. 4 breath in, 4 breath out. Box breathing, or with my first responders, you know, you call it tactical or combat breathing, because
you gotta make it sound
tactical in front of it. Right, if you put tactical in front of it, a cop's gonna go, yeah, I'll do that. That doesn't sound too hippy dippy for me.
Yep. It is very true, especially those tactical minded cops that need it the most.
Yep. Yep. If I call it combat breathing, then they'll be like, okay, I may listen to what's going on here. But yeah, you know, 4 breath, 4 in, 4 hold, 4 out, hold, and do that again. And when I'm regulating my breathing, again, I'm sending signals to my survival brain that we're safe, that everything is okay. Because I'm not hyperventilating, I'm sucking in oxygen for fight or flight. So that starts to send that signal to my brain that, hey, it's okay. And so I think doing that in between calls, when you get off that critical incident, first of all, I think when you have that critical incident where, you know, the baby just died in my arms, people should be removed from the road for a while.
Should be.
You know, not as a punishment.
Hopefully they're able to be, but I know, like, when I was working, I know so many, especially these days with the short staffing numbers, you know, the lower numbers, you got 10 calls waiting that are priority. Right. And so, but having that technique of that breathing, you know, I started implementing after I left law enforcement. I was told about like cold plunges and cold showers and that. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so many people, you know, there's so much research out there around what it does for your muscles and what it does for your, you know, all these different, you know, things and the chemicals of your brain. And everybody asks me, oh, why do you do it, Chris? And I go, because it forces me to calm my brain. Mm-hmm. It forces me to breathe calmly under a stressful situation. I was like, when I do it, I don't love to do it every single time. And my wife, it's funny. She can actually, like, she'll be in the bathroom and I'll, because every shower I flick it to cold. It feels weird if I don't do it. I've not done it once because I was freezing already because it was really cold here in New Zealand. And so I was like, okay. And I was having a shower just to warm up and I didn't turn it to cold. And I got out and I was like, I feel like something's missing because I do it so often. Right. But when I flick it over to cold, my wife can actually hear, especially if the water is really cold, She's like, oh, daddy's got it. She says to our dogs, dad's put the shower to cold because my breathing changes. It calms down and it breathes really mm-hmm. deep in it because it forces me to stay, to go to that calm place. And I can tell when my mind is in that kind of fight or flight because of work, not because of law enforcement anymore, because I'm not in, but that I can tell when it's not because the water is extremely cold and it takes me even longer to calm that breathing down. But then with that breathing, as you probably know, and I'm sorry if I'm jumping ahead here, but it calms the heart rate down as well. It lowers adrenaline. It reduces the cortisol. All the chemical sides of things happen with the breathing.
Yeah. If I can get that survival brain to shut down and go to sleep, so many cool things happen. Yes, I'm not dumping adrenaline and cortisol into my system. We all know that cortisol is not good for us. It sits in our system. When we dump it into our system, it sits in our muscles. It doesn't naturally leave, we have to sweat it out. So now I've got cortisol sitting in my muscles, sitting around my heart, which is a heart muscle, which is a muscle. So, you know, why do retired cops have short lifespans? Because we haven't done any of this stuff up front and we have heart disease, you know? Most importantly is when I get my survival brain to shut down, I can get my thinking brain to come back online. And then I can start to think through things logically. Mm. You know, it's when I go from that critical incident, that benign call, I'm still in super survival brain. Thinking brain isn't involved in this situation. And logic, the logical part of my brain that says, hey, don't yell at this lady, isn't interacting with anything.
Because our survival brain's there, you know, you take that incident, you know, yelling at somebody or yelling at this lady. That is a fight or flight thing because we're in a heightened alertness. So it's like, oh, I know that when I yell at somebody or I raise my voice, it becomes a commanding situation. So it makes things happen faster when it's not actually necessary in that situation. Actually being calm and talking to them politely is probably going to get more done.
Yeah. And the other thing with law enforcement is that we don't usually run away. I mean, we're kind of taught that flight mechanism is kind of tamped down. It's always move forward, always fight. Yes, there is such thing as a tactical retreat. you know,
Again, tactical.
you know, get behind cover, get more people, but move forward. Nobody in law enforcement has the option to just go, yeah, I'm not doing this. Peace out.
Yeah. Yeah.
So not only are we in fight or flight all the time, we're in fight all the time.
Yeah, it's so true. Now you touched on some of the languaging, like the starting to process things and that, you know. So you start doing the breathing, you start doing the being able to think logically. I have a belief that the thoughts that you put into your brain, like you can shift the language that you use, that you're using even in your own brain and your way that you're speaking, and it shifts the outcome of what you actually get out of it.
Absolutely.
Is this something that you talk to law enforcement and that around as well, once they actually are able to calm that brain down so they can actually think logically, mm-hmm. not just from an emotional state?
Absolutely. Yeah, when I talk to, and I do this with all of my clients, because negative self-talk is a huge thing. We all have negative self-talk that we don't pay attention to. You know, one of my examples is that I would never call another human being an idiot, but I'll call myself an idiot 1,000 times a day over some small mistake. And so, combining, you know, relaxation and breathing and grounding techniques. So grounding techniques, things that I can do to force my thinking brain back online when I need it, you know, saying the days of the week in reverse order, alphabetizing the months of the year, you know, how many breeds of dogs can I name? All of that stuff that requires cognition is going to force my thinking brain back online and get survival brain to calm down. And I've had clients who said, you know, I've tried to solve the problem and then ground. I'm like, yeah, you're putting the cart before the horse. You got to ground and get your thinking brain back online before you can solve the problem. So let's practice that. But yeah, I absolutely believe in language and how we talk to ourselves, and this idea that our brains, when I was growing up, you're probably much younger than me, but when I was growing up, there was this philosophy around the brain that, you know, if you drink a beer, you kill a brain cell, and that brain cell never comes back, and then you kill enough brain cells and it's game over. What we've learned in the last 30 years is that our brain continues to make these neural networks throughout our lives, unless there's some like physical damage or neurodegenerative, like Alzheimer's or something like that. Our brain is always making connections. And those connections are developed by thought. So if I think something, positive, it's going to bring two neurons together. And the more I do that, I'm going to build a neurocluster until I've got a neuro pathway that shoots toward the positive. It's the same thing that we do in when we do training as first responders. You know, I asked my paramedics, the first time you stuck a needle in somebody's arm to give meds or just to start an IV, was it in the middle of the street with chaos all over the place? And it takes them a minute. And then they go, well, yeah, probably. I go, no, the first time you did it was when you were in paramedic school. And you did it 1,000 times in paramedic school. You know, I've been off the road 20 some odd years now. I left 99, early 2000s. But if you handed me a firearm, I could probably do one arm tap rack drills.
Yeah.
Just
because you've done them so many times.
Yeah. And that's what we do is, We do that so that when we're in that situation and thinking brain isn't there, we've got the pictures already there that says, oh, this is what I do when I see my gun do this thing.
Yeah.
And so we can take that and do it for other stuff. We can talk nicer to ourselves and have better body image. We can tell ourselves different things about the world and have a better outlook on the world. But what we do, we get into this habit in law enforcement, especially because we don't see the good all the time, that we just start to believe that the world is an awful place and that everybody is an asshole.
Well, yeah, you're spending 60 to 80 hours a week, mostly when you're doing overtime and doing all the extra shifts that you're, you know, in the US, you're allowed to do double shifts and you can get extra overtime and you can do all the different things, which they don't allow here. You just have the mandated overtime on your shift when, you know, something bad happens or things are going on. But so you're doing 60-ish on average hours a week, and then you're going home and you're thinking about it and you never actually letting it calm down. Then you're going to your buddy's house who you work with as well, and then you're talking about all the negative stuff and you're bitching and moaning and complaining and all this.
Yeah.
So you're actually spending, like, you know, 120 of the 168 hours a week.
Yeah, exactly.
Whereas if you can, as you said, if you can shift it to into that positive, even when you're on shift, it's pretty, you know, it can be pretty, you know, you got to catch yourself, and it's a vigilance, and it's a thing to do that you have to constantly do, which as ex-law enforcement, I still have to catch myself going, oh, wait a second, no, that person's not evil, they are good. There is good in them.
Yeah.
So that you can, you know, stay with that, and as you said, because you'll create those neural pathways for the negative, or you'll create them for the positive.
Right. And I, you know, one of the things that I remember about my career in law enforcement and some of the things I cherished were those good connections with people. I remember standing in line at a fast food restaurant to get my dinner one night, and this little teeny girl comes up and, you know, is like, hi, officer. And, you know, I got down on my knees and I was talking to her, and her mom's pregnant. She's like, mommy has a baby in her belly. And you know, we had this really nice conversation, and it was like, okay, that's good.
Yeah.
that was good, you know, or my husband will come home from work and be and talk about, you know, I went to this guy's house and he had a dog and we petted the dog, you know, and there was dog play time. And it was like, okay, cool.
Yeah.
So it's, I think, taking those good moments that we do have in this job, when, you know, you drive by and the little kid waves at you and says, hey, can you turn your lights on? Or can I see your car? Or whatever it is, taking those moments and cherishing them and reliving those and going, okay, not everybody is evil.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. Now, I'm a huge prevention guy. I like to think about, you know, and as from having things that happen constantly and, you know, overcoming them, we can learn from that on how to actually prevent it. You know, as humans, we normally don't take action on things until we've actually experienced it or there's been some sort of pain, which is kind of sad. But if you hear it a lot, then yeah, I guess hopefully, and my brain is going, hopefully you'll put it in place before you hit that painful time.
Right.
You'll learn from your elders' mistakes. I guess we can call it. What are some of the things, what would be the key three things that you would say to a new police officer or, you know, somebody who's kind of doesn't feel like they've hit PTSD, that kind of they want to do the preventative thing? What would be like three mm-hmm. things that you would recommend to them to start doing right now?
Develop and maintain friendships outside of the job, like people who don't do the job. So that you, I mean, one of my saving graces, my best friend was not in law enforcement. She was a bartender and did some other, you know, worked, she had corporate jobs and stuff, but she was the person that I went home to and, you know, it was a de-escalation because we didn't talk about it. You know, we talked about the cow, you know, the cute cowboy at the bar. That's when I was single. You know,
hey, even if you're married, you can still talk about the cute cowboy at the bar. I mean, there's nothing wrong with
it. You can. Absolutely.
as long as, you know, it's that whole saying, you know, it doesn't matter where you get your hunger from, as long as you eat at home.
Exactly. You know, she and I actually had a ritual when I worked midnight shift. Like every Sunday, we would watch, bull riding, and then I would go to work. Or we would watch Buffy the Vampire Slayer together, eat bomb pops with the cat, and then I would go to work. And that was kind of, you know, so she was having that. And then I had a lot of other friends in that circle that were not in law enforcement. And so having that outlet where it's like, I don't have to talk about this. I don't have to deal with this. You know, it's not in my circle 24/7. So yeah. Get people outside of the job that you can be friendly with and maintain those friendships. Do stuff with those people. Get and develop hobbies and keep them that are not related to your job. You know, as we said earlier, before we started recording, going to the range is not a hobby. As much as you think going to the range and blowing off rounds it may help you. It may relieve some of that stress, but it's not a hobby. It's a skill development set. It's skill development. Mm-hmm. So go fishing, you know, do a craft, learn stained glass, whatever. Find something else that isn't your job.
Yeah. We talked about this before. You know, I used to go to the range and I used to do 3-gun shooting because, you know, it was a little bit, you know, kind of a little bit more outside of law enforcement, but still was helping my, you know, my policing career, especially when I was doing protection services, you know, diplomatic protection. And when I was doing it, the focus that I had on it is I'm doing this so I'm better at work because I don't get enough training mm-hmm. at work with firearms. So I'm going to go do this. Luckily, my dad imports firearms. And so he was sponsoring me, paid for all my memberships, my ammo and my guns and literally all of it. Yeah. So I didn't have to pay for any of it. But what I recognize now is that the 3-gun, like you said, it's a skill building for work. But the 3-gun, I always focused on, okay, cool, I'm coming here so I'm better for work. And if I had shifted right. that language like we talked about before of, oh, I'm here to build camaraderie with guys that aren't cops. I'm here to have fun. And yes, the secondary side of it is it's bettering me for work, is putting skills in it. Mm-hmm. But I'm here for the camaraderie, for the friendships, for the people that aren't cops. So we can talk about other random shit that has nothing to do with policing. But the secondary is that. And then also have those things that have nothing to do with it. Like, I do it really well now. I paraglide. And so, like, it has nothing. I yacht race. I've gotten back into yacht racing, which I grew up sailing. So it's kind of, I should have kept it while I was in law enforcement, but I use the I'm too busy, excuse. Yeah. But having those, I don't even talk about my job now. And it's skills that I learned by hitting rock bottom as a cop of, oh, I should have done this while I was a cop. Okay, I'm going to do it in my own business. Now I'm going to have times where I just do not think about work. I don't talk about work. I don't, because again, like you said, it is so powerful on that. What's number three?
What was number three? Oh, I think number three is go to counseling. Have somebody in your support circle that you can offload things to, that is going to be sensitive to that, that is going to be open to that. I always say you don't have to go to counseling when a crisis happens. Go to counseling and just say, hey, this is my job. I see a bunch of crappy things all the time. I would like to offload this to somebody before I go home and traumatize my partner. You know, and that's fine. Find a culturally competent therapist. Find somebody who knows what the job is and how it works. Because I've heard so many horror stories of, yeah, I traumatized my therapist.
I love that one, because it's something that, you know, if I ever went back to law enforcement, I would continuously do. I'd have a coach, or I'd have a therapist, or I'd have somebody. And yes, there's the I traumatized my therapist. And I always question that sometimes, because I'm like, is that a projection they put onto the therapist, because the therapist has gone, oh, wow, you've got a lot of stuff. And they've heard it as I traumatized them, or
I've heard of therapists breaking down and crying.
I've heard, yeah, that's traumatizing.
What the law enforcement officer has said. Yeah. Like, and then the first responder has to now become now I have to go back into that mode of support and safety and taking care. Yeah.
Yeah. The savior side of stuff. Which you know, shows the side of the therapist really should be like, I don't know enough about the traumas of the job. But anyways, we digress on that. But you know,
to that point real quick, I think what happens is there's not enough culturally competent people in the EAP system. So what happens is I go through my EAP, I just get assigned a therapist who is probably a very good therapist, but doesn't know anything. Because I've done that. As when I was in law enforcement, I did a stint in the EAP. And while I didn't traumatize my therapist, I remember thinking, wow, this person doesn't know who I am or what I do. They don't get it.
I think it's also on the back of that. It's also, even if they do get it, they're not necessarily always right for you. And that's okay.
Yeah, you know, and that's
I went to EAP twice in my career, once at the very end, which was after I wanted a divorce. And my wife got me to go to counseling again, and we're still together. We didn't get a divorce because of that counselor. But I had the police psychologist before that, like 3 years earlier, 2 years earlier, mm-hmm. and also EAP 2 years earlier than that, like around the same time as the police psychologist. They did nothing for me.
Yeah,
I thought they did at the time, but really, if I look back on it, all they did was feed into my wanting to run away and my hating the job. They just let me vent my stuff, and venting my stuff is great. And this is where I want to get on and get your opinions on it as well, with, you know, off the back of your third one of getting counseling. Is if you're just going and venting and you're not actually getting anything to actually process and work through it, it's not that's not counseling. That's just a bitching session.
Correct. And I think that if you have a good therapist, you can find that balance.
Yeah.
Because I will have people come in and go, hey, I know the tools. I know how to get through this, but I've got to get this out of my head. So I just need to vent this out. Cool. And then once you vent it out, okay, do we need to process it? Do we need to talk about it? Do we need to do any breathing? Do we need to do any? Nope, I'm good. I have the answer. I just needed to get to it.
But right there, by you asking them if they need any of those tools, you're all of a sudden sparking the thing back up of, oh, these are the tools that you can use for it, but you're not telling them that they have to. And right. And, you know, as I had, and I can only speak from my experience, there was none of that. There was like, I didn't even have the tools back then. It was like, okay, cool, I'm here. And it's like, oh yeah, no, I get you. You know, yeah, there's this. And, you know, yeah, you know, you're processing stuff and that. I'm like, okay. And I went and I thought I dealt with everything. And then wow, did it rear its head back up and really bad in the end. But yeah. On the back of that is if you aren't, and I guess, you know, back then I thought I was getting help in that. But if you're not getting any kind of tools and getting changes, I would say look for different counselors.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah, you should. It, you know, when we go through counseling school, they say that it's a 70-30, that the client should be talking 70% of the time and you should only be talking 30% of the time. But I think that, again, I think education up front is really important. That's telling people, especially first responders, that, hey, you're not going crazy. You're burnt out. Your brain is overstimulated. And here's how we can fix it. And then reinforcing those tools as you go. You know, the next, I'll teach them a relaxation exercise. And the next session, I'll be like, okay, how did that work out for you? Well, I didn't really like, I teach a pelvic relaxation, which is amazing. But, you know, I've had people go, yeah, I tried it. I didn't really like it. Cool. Let's find another relaxation that works for you. You know, how did the breathing go this week?
Yeah,
sometimes I forgot to breathe, but for the most part, I got it. You know, and then we may move into journaling and we may move into, you know, thought stopping. And okay, so how did it work this week with catching your thoughts or change reframing or, you know, reinforcing that stuff? But I also tell all of my clients, I may have an agenda for our session, but your agenda is number one. So if we planned on, we're going to talk about grounding today, but you come in and go, hey, this really awful thing happened last night and I need to talk about it. Great. Cool. We're going to put my agenda aside and we're going to deal with what you need to deal with.
We're going to process your stuff because that's the most important. It's funny. I was talking to my, cause I've got a coach now, like half the time I'm like, oh no, I don't even need to turn up to the session. I'll turn up there. I'm like, oh my God, thank God I did. Because you know, it's getting stuff out and she'll, again, same sort of thing. It's like, what's going on? How's things going? And we kind of the first 20 minutes or so, it's like, it's going through that. And then it's kind of starts to coach and, you know, work through things and implement, you know, new things if we need to, or just reinforce old things. And we're talking about kids and brushing their teeth. And the reason that we were talking about this was because, you know, I have a ton of tools and she always is saying, she's like, I know that this is like, you know, you've got these tools. I'm just reminding you of them. And, you know, what is it? Even as a teenager, we still have to remind kids to brush their teeth millions and millions and millions of times. A really quite simple thing that you should be able to remember to do. But we have to remind them a million times. How is it that we can expect law enforcement who are in this state of stimulation to be able to process their emotions and their feelings and the jobs that they go to on their own by telling them like one or two times? And I know you don't do this. You remind and that, but you see it a lot, especially like departments in that. It's like, oh, you know, we'll run this one training and we'll expect the cops to take it away. This is why, again, off the back of the counseling, and I go on and on about this because it's something that I wish that I had. I wish that it was forced in law enforcement monthly counseling, that, you know, it's like, cool, it's paid for. You just go and like turn up if you want to talk. If there's stuff that you got to talk about, no, cool. Just, you know, because same thing as my coach. I see her weekly and it's like some weeks I'm like, oh, there's nothing here. And then we just start talking. Oh, wait a second. There was something there. And so it's, you know, that continual habit is the only way to actually reinforce it. You know, it's taken me years to be able to process some of the stuff. I've been out of law enforcement for 5 years. It's taken me, I still struggle with some stuff that stemmed from law enforcement that I'm still processing 5 years later.
Yeah. I just, I, probably 4 years ago when I went through my accelerated resolution therapy training, I processed out a shooting that happened early on in my career. And it was like, I didn't real, well, I did, because when I would talk about it in, when I would teach recruits about stress and about adrenaline, I would tell this story. And every time I told the story, I would feel my adrenaline pump up. I would feel that reaction on a lower level. And I ended up processing that out on a, in a training that I took. And now I can tell the story without the reaction. So yeah, I think it's, and I think with a good therapist, I have a client who comes in and she'll do 15 minutes and like, okay, that's all I got. And I'm like, okay. And I just sit there and stare at her and be like, okay, so here we go. So here's this thing. And then we end up doing a full session because it's like, okay, we'll just sit in silence for a minute and see where that goes.
Well, I mean, how many cops sit in silence?
Right. It's great when I do trainings and I ask, you know, I ask a room full of cops a question and, you know, nobody wants to answer. And I'm like, here's the deal. I'm a therapist. I can sit in silence for hours. So we'll just sit here until somebody raises their hand.
I like that. I need to start using that because it is. It's so true with law enforcement, man. You ask them a question and it's like nothing. Crickets.
Yeah. Yeah. I do a substance use training every other month for law enforcement officers. And of course, you know, they don't want to, well, they usually sign up for it. It's not a mandatory, but yeah, it's like, okay, so how many of you have, what do you feel about this, that? And they're like, yeah, okay, I can sit in silence for an hour, so.
Yeah.
And then I just stare at them uncomfortably.
Yeah. No, it is very true. So Meredith, if somebody wants to get in touch with you, if they want to learn about your services or they want to ask for your services, how do they find you? How do they get in touch?
The easiest way to get in touch with me is through my website, www.flwellness.org. Let me try that again. My company is Frontline Wellness. My website is flwellness.org. Now, I'm only licensed in the state of Florida, but I can see anybody in the state of Florida. I do telehealth. So if you're in the panhandle of Florida and you want to have a session with me, we can do it over video. I'll give you my phone number too. It's 727-316-0798.
Cool. Perfect.
And that's my office number. So people can call me up. If somebody wants to book me for a training, I will go anywhere to do that. So you can do that through the website too.
Awesome. Cool. Well, I'll put that, I'll make sure that those are down in the show notes as well, so that people can click on those and have a look. Meredith, last question I have for you, and I want to thank you again for being here, taking the time and, you know, telling all these tools. And before we go any further, I just want to remind you, just grab one of those and just start making them happen. They sound really simple, but the amount of cops that I talk to, I'm like, oh, you know, how many friends do you have outside the job? And they're like, oh, you know, I have this one friend. And I was like, okay, how often do you see them? Oh, maybe every 6 months. Yeah. So just start implementing one, you know, what is one thing? There's a lot of learnings today. But Meredith, last question I have for you is, what is your top tip to self-happiness?
Oh, wow. You know what? I think I go back to self-talk. And listening to the things we say to ourselves and changing the picture, reframing when we're talking negative to ourselves and reframing that into a happiness, into positivity. You know, happiness, we can't get happiness from external things, from external feedback. It's got to come from inside. And so, yeah, I think listening to our self-talk and changing the way we perceive ourselves and perceive the world.
I love it. There you go. Self-talk, guys, everybody. That self-talk's so important.
Positive self-talk.
Positive self-talk. That positive self-talk, you know. It's I use the example just so that people kind of get a different thing. And I'd love to hear if you've got an example, but I always talk about the, I want to go on holiday or I want to go on vacation, whichever one, you know, wherever you are in the world, we say holiday, you say vacation. I want to go on vacation. And, you know, you're like, it's kind of, you know, it'll happen one day, or I got to, you know, all the excuses come in. Whereas if you change that language just a little bit, or even that self-talk in your head around it, I'm going on vacation.
Yeah.
Then you start to go, oh, well, where do I want to go actually? And you start to actually think of the positive things of how you make it happen. Just to shift the language just slightly.
Yeah. I think I am are two of the most powerful words. Not I want to be or I will be, but I am. I'm a big believer in act as if. Yep. You know, I've been losing weight. I've been kind of on this, doing this new health thing since the first of the year. And it's, you know, okay, what do thin people do? Okay. And kind of having that attitude of what does that look like? Act as if.
Yeah.
You know, the best, do you have time for one quick
story? We do. Yes, definitely.
Okay. The best advice I ever got, I was 2 weeks away from being released from field training. They were going to, here's your car, here's your gun, go protect the city on your own, have a nice time. And I was sitting with a buddy of mine who'd been at the agency for probably 6 or 7 years at that point. And I'm like, dude, I have made a serious career error. I don't know what I'm doing. I don't have any other skills. I'm going to be working at McDonald's and living in my parents' house for the rest of my life. I am screwed. And he looked at me and goes, here's the deal. You won't know what you're doing for the first year. Or no, for the first 2 years, just go out there and fake it like the rest of us and you'll do fine.
Kind of true.
And, yeah.
It's kind of true.
And I would tell, when I taught recruits, I would tell them that. And I would say, you can see yourself shift where you go, I don't know what I'm doing. Let me watch a bunch of people do it. And then you shift to, not sure if this is right. Let me ask somebody. And then that shift happens really subtly where you're like, I'm in charge of this call and I need you to do that and you to do that. And this is what I'm going to do. And we have it under control.
Which is why the podcast is here.
Yep.
It's the same exact thing. We're just trying to give everybody, all you listeners and viewers, that same exact knowledge. You know,
yeah.
Mental mindset awareness and mindset, you know, work is not something that we all know how to do. We're not trained it as a kid.
Mm-mm.
And so, you know, put it on your tool belt. We like to put all these appointments on our tool belt. You know, you look at those tactical guys and they've got like stuff for Africa and you're like, how the hell do you run? Put this on there as well. You know?
Yeah.
Awesome, Meredith. Well, thank you very much. Any last words before we wrap up?
No, I mean, thank you for having me. It's been an honor. I'm glad that we got to schedule this and I hope that it helps. I hope that some people take some tools away and, you know, and again, even if you're not in the state of Florida and you want to call and have a conversation, I just can't do therapy with you. We can have a conversation.
Yeah.
I just can't legally do therapy with you.
You can't therapize them, but you can have a conversation and coach them.
We can have a conversation. Yeah.
Awesome. Well, Meredith, thank you very much. And everybody who's listening and watching, thank you very much as well. I appreciate the support and your wanting to learn. This is Fight the Burnout. If you want to learn more about Fight the Burnout, you want to learn more about myself, go to createfromwhy.com. That's createfromwhy.com. And we will, you know, you can contact us there. You can email us. It's createfromwhy@gmail.com. Pretty simple, pretty straightforward. And send us an email and we can put you in touch with people. If we can't help you ourselves, we can organize a conversation, whatever you need. If you want to get in touch with Meredith, check the show notes. Her website, email, and phone number will be down there. Feel free to reach out to her, even if you wanted, you know, just a little tip or a trick or just want to have a conversation. I'm sure she will always answer her phone when she's not with a client. Again, I'll remind you, take one thing away from today and start putting it in action. It takes 20-ish days, 21 days to start a habit. It takes 90 days to actually make it a habit. And then you still have to constantly work on it. And I'm a fitness guy. I train all the time, but I still have to work on it every day. I'm not motivated to go do it. So without further ado, thank you all for watching. Make sure you like, subscribe, share this to somebody, share this to a family member, a law enforcement officer, a first responder that you know, so that they can get some tools as well. Train hard, test easy, and we will talk to you very soon.